not going to think like an educator. I'm just going to think like a student. And that was part of the shift for me. I started to think about, what can I learn that I've had trouble with using this technology?
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones, sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Thank you for joining us. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast.
Welcome to the Digital to Learn podcast. I am Mike Jones, and I'm co-hosting today with my co-host, Brad Garner. Welcome, Brad.
Hey, Mike. I do have a favor to ask. We, of course, are missing our friend Tiffany today joining us for this. Would you mind greatly speaking in a falsetto voice? That would just make me feel much more comfortable.
I can try, but it could get old
really fast.
Perfect. Hopefully, our guest will not be speaking in his falsetto. We have a guest, Jason Gulia, today joining us on the podcast. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here and talk to both of you about everything learning, everything technology and AI.
Now, I thought for sure he was going to take that bait and say, oh, I'm so glad to be here. Thank you.
No, it's not good. My voice only goes so high and then it just straight up cracks. I can't go any higher.
Jason did say he's good with ad lib. So, you know, if we run anything we want to throw at him, we're good.
Gary.
Yeah, go for it.
Brad, you want to ask the first question today?
Sure. These are in the realm of getting to know you better, Jason. And as one of the most important decisions we make in life is our life partner. And a mouse told us you proposed to yours in a magical place. Could you tell us more about that?
I did. So I've been married, oh my gosh, going to make me do my math, about 8 years, going on 8 years. So I actually proposed to my wife, and now we have 2 kids, basically about almost 8.5, 9 years ago in Disney World. So my wife and her entire family are huge Disney fans. It was so different because she's just used to going there all the time and did ever since she was a kid. I went there when I was about 2, and then I went there again when I was about 27.
Nice.
Go in the middle. And one of the things that's so cool about it, and it actually does affect the way that I approach teaching, is it's all about storytelling. All along the way, not just in terms of movies, but like the fireworks and the parks themselves and every element of the park, they all tell stories and they're very much caught up in that, which has helped me out. So that's a way to link that proposal, which was a long time ago, and I really think about it now, to teaching, what I do every day.
So if I could give you some marital advice, Jason, when you describe this story, to say, you should know exactly how long ago it was at any given moment in time.
I'm just going to blame my math, not my memory.
That's good. We've seen a couple of things where like people are proposing and a park bouncer or something like tackles them because they're in the wrong place. I'm like, oh, that would be awful. Yeah. Well, besides Disney, we have it on good authority that your wife enjoys books, movies, and TV. So who gets to control the remote at your house and what is usually on the screen?
We try to compromise as much as we possibly can. The way that it's worked out is that I have basically a list of shows that I watch with her and then a list of shows that I watch on my own, things that she's not that interested in. They tend to be more violent, more graphic. So right now we are actually in the process of, and we didn't really decide this, it just happened, of rewatching ER. My wife loves medical dramas and she has shows that are on her list that she just watches on her own. So I would say more often than not, we have procedurals that we like to watch together. And then every once in a while, like a comedy, if there's one that I want to watch and she'll try and she likes it. Other than that, we split off and do our own thing.
Do you have any recent favorites?
TV shows?
Yeah.
I'm actually in the process of rewatching Breaking Bad. that ended a little while ago. So I'm a fan of that. And I'm actually, I say rewatching it, but rewatching it from the beginning because I never actually finished it.
Okay, no spoilers.
Exactly. Although at this point, I just assume everything's online. It's been around for so long. But yeah, so that's one that I was watching recently. Also getting into just science fiction. So The Silo is the big one that I was watching. So it's on Apple TV. So very much in this sci-fi post-apocalyptic world. So I was really into that. And that was exciting and interesting. It is a set of narrative techniques as well, because if you watch that show, they have no problems giving you character development and then just finishing, right? Getting rid of them, killing them off, which is the way that a lot of modern narrative has gone.
Yeah.
I think I still hold the world record for this. I was working on a book, and the way I usually do that is I sit in my chair, I've got the TV on as background noise, and I watched 4 seasons of Breaking Bad in 1 week.
That's a lot. It's very impressive just in terms of the time commitment.
That's right. It is Valentine's Day, even though this episode will release later. And that's all about love. And being married is one expression of love in a person's life. But having kids really amps it up. So we understand you may have a couple of coworkers here today. How has become a dad shaped the way you think about artificial intelligence and the future?
Really, in many ways, being a dad, and I have a 3-year-old, and then I have a 4-month-old who's just sitting here. I'm actually on leave. I've been on leave for a few weeks already, and I have a couple months left. But in many ways, it's why I care so much. It's why I really push myself. So on those days when I feel like I don't want to think about artificial intelligence anymore, I just don't want to think about this technology. And then I think about them, and I that actually gives me that sort of push, because we are at a point now when a lot of this technology is being embedded in our society, right? It's been happening for a little while behind the scenes, and now we're just so aware of it. But for my 3-year-old, and certainly for my 4-month-old, they're just going to grow up with it. Yeah, it's going to be a part. I have every reason to believe that Theo and Parker, my 2 sons, will grow up with this as a major part of their schooling. And when they get jobs, when they get to that point, a major part of their jobs. And that's a good and a bad way. I think that I'm going to be much more sensitized to things like surveillance, likely, than my kids ever will be. And we have all these ways that, at least for me, we need to shape this technology. One of the things that I truly believe is that if we don't, over the next year or so, push to shape how this technology is being used, it's just going to do it on its own. Or ed tech companies are going to do it, or the government's going to do it. And I think that there are so many different reasons why we shouldn't just pass the buck to them, that we should push, that if we want it to be integrated in certain ways, we have to push now. And my kids are the thing that really pushes me to do that. We need to do it now, because if we do it in a year, if we do it 2 years, I think it's just going to be too late. I think it's going to be so much more embedded than it is right now, because this technology is moving so quickly.
It's hard to even imagine the level of technology that your kids are going to experience in their lifetimes. We're so enamored now with AI and how, with the impact it will have. Think about the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 10th generation of that as we move forward. It's mind-blowing.
Yeah, I sincerely believe that when we look back at something like ChatGPT or really any of these AI programs in a year, I think we're going to be horrified. I think that we're going to look back and just say, these were awful. They weren't functioning very well. The UX wasn't very good. The outputs weren't very good. And that's what I think we're going to go through.
Yeah.
And then just think, add another 10 years to that. And then say that my kids won't even see those initial versions. They're just going to see the really advanced ones and the kind of know you really well, better than your, maybe even your friend or your spouse, at least in terms of your behavior. They'll know your behavior if they don't know the emotional side of it.
Yeah.
And I think that we need to really be careful with what we're doing with this technology. There are huge ethical concerns. And I think now pre-embedding or pre-being embedded everywhere, I think now that's where we can do it. Because you're right. I think we can't even fathom what this technology is going to be like and how it's going to be used in 5 years, let alone 10 years or 20 years.
I see a lot of people, their minds are blown with the new Apple Vision Pros. And this one guy says, this will be the worst version of this we'll ever see. I was like, cool.
Which you could say for any progress.
That's right. Whoa.
Jason, I ran across a post that you made on LinkedIn. And the beauty of it, I thought, was you had a list of things. Here are the things that I am for in relation to AI. And here are the things that I'm against. I just love that perspective. Thinking about it so critically, it's just a beautiful list.
And I honestly don't even remember what I have on that published version of the list, because it's always changing.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is that I think that as this technology advances, we just come across these uses of AI, really any technology, these uses that we didn't even fathom, that we couldn't even think, oh, you could use it that way. And then once we come across it, I think that we have to be, and this is what I was trying to do with that list, be very careful about where we land on it. It is okay to say no. One of the things that I push against is this narrative of inevitability, And it's everywhere. If you go on social media and as you talk to people, right, this language and this assumption that AI is simply, it's a this million ton train that's just going to go through everything. You can't actually have it change direction. You can't slow it down. I understand where that idea is coming from, right? It's trying to get us to adapt. But I think that has gone too far. Yeah. I think that there are ways that we can shape how this technology is being used and need to shape how it's being used. And part of it has to be able to say, actually, I'm not okay with this. Mm-hmm. I'm actually not okay with my sons going to a world where they're monitored 24/7 and there is no offstage time. I'm not okay with that. And just saying that, I think that's a first step to shaping the technology. And he has ideas too.
He's sharing them. Yeah, it's very Black Mirror-esque, that idea.
You have conversations with your colleagues. What would you say is their general perspective on AI as it impacts their work?
Most of them haven't played with it sufficiently.
Okay.
I was reading a LinkedIn post by Ethan Mollick a few weeks ago, and he talked about this idea that it takes about 10 hours. It takes about 10 hours of using AI for use cases to start bubbling up so that you start thinking, oh, I can use it this way. I can use it this way. I can bring it into my workflow, or I can teach a particular concept or lesson using AI in an improved way. And here's how. And I think that most of the faculty members I have talked to just haven't gotten there. They haven't gotten to the point where they've played with it enough. And many of them been in a couple of camps. One camp is that they haven't really played with it much at all. They know it's there. They know it's on the horizon. I think that most faculty members I talk to know that it's around and students are using it, but they haven't really even gone in and used it a couple of times. And then I have another camp of faculty members that go in, use it, and are giving these kind of generic prompts and are getting very generic outputs. And so they move on from it. They say, okay, this is never going to replace us. It's never going to do what it's supposed to do. And so they move on from it. And so you have those two camps, and then you have some faculty members who are between them, right? They've played with it a little bit more. And for me, what is eventually going to happen, I think, is AI is going to sneak into colleges. And I think it's going to sneak in through eventually faculty use and administration use. That there are many, I run across many faculty members, and this isn't just faculty members, this is administrators, this is staff. And sometimes this is students, too, who are very anti-AI. They want it out of the college space and out of the education space. And that, in many ways, is held strong, at least partially. I think it's starting to break down. But I think what's going to really happen is once institutions, and for me, college in many ways is just a kind of weird and large company that's got business. That's how I conceptualize it. And as soon as they start to see that, oh, it's worked into, and this has already happened, admissions. Most admissions offices are using AI. I was talking to my wife a few days ago, and we have a friend who's applying to grad school. And the grad school process says that they send in the application and they get a rejection or an acceptance within a week. My wife went to me and said, this is a legitimate college, right? And it's LSU, right? And I said, yeah, it's a legitimate college. And I said, this is what they're doing behind the scenes, right? And that's the case with most colleges. So I think that as AI gets worked into admissions and eventually the workflows of more administrators, more faculty members, then I think it's going to start to change the stigma behind it. And then I think eventually faculty members are more amenable to student use of it.
So with that as a backdrop, could you tell us about your own journey from a fear of AI to becoming an evangelist for it?
Yeah. And I don't use the word evangelist because I like to think of myself as more critical than that. Although there are a lot of evangelists of AI that have this critical bent to them as well. But yeah, the first time I played with AI really significantly was ChatGPT. I'd played with it a little bit before. Actually, a few months before ChatGPT came out, I was creating this unit for my classes around AI-powered writing. And then ChatGPT came out, and then it just became this kind of all-in effort. And I used ChatGPT for a few hours, and I talked to my wife, who was on the other side of the table, and I said to her, I just came across the most awful, terrible program I've ever seen, and this is the future of plagiarism. That's where I began. And it was so bad that I ended up putting the program aside for several days. I think almost a week. It was like 5 or 6 days. I just put it aside. I said, I can't play with this anymore. I just can't. I didn't have the mental strength to push through and just use it anymore. So I put it aside. And then I went back to it. And what I did was I said, I'm not going to think like a teacher. I'm not going to think like an educator. I'm just going to think like a student. And that was part of the shift for me. I started to think about, what can I learn that I've had trouble with using this technology? So one of the ones that I did probably about a month or so later was I, for years, struggled with conceptualizing cryptocurrency and Bitcoin. I just couldn't do it. I read about it. I did all this research. I just don't get it. I still don't get it. And I decided to take ChatGPT and take 5 to 10 minutes and just use it. I bounced ideas off of it. I got definitions. I asked questions. And I learned more in about 10 minutes than I had reading all these different articles. Mm. And that was part of the big shift for me. Thinking about it as a learner, I think shifts our mindset and opens up us up to these possibilities. Because there are, if we're using it ethically and we're using it responsibly, there are huge advantages to using AI programs like ChatGPT. And now, whether I'm an evangelist or a consultant, whatever you want to call me, now I'm in this space when I'm trying to get people, in many ways, I'm trying to get people to the 10 hours, right? It may not be exactly 10 hours, but there's some number, I think, where you start to see these use cases just pop up naturally as you play with the technology and you think about how it connects to your everyday life. And so I'm trying to coach more and more practitioners to get to that point, because then they can come up with their own use cases, their own ideas, their own prompts, whatever they want. And yeah, so that's where I am now. That's where I started. And that's where I am today.
That's awesome. Excellent. Brad had already mentioned one of your previous posts, and I found another one here. You posted a comment that read, AI detection software isn't the future of education. Proof of work is. I think this is one of those questions that are on a lot of administrator minds. Oh, look at there. Our audience can't see the video, but we just got a view of a 4-month-old.
A collaborator.
Collaborator.
Yeah. It's his first podcast he's actually been on.
On the Digital to Learn podcast. So when we think about AI detection software versus proof of work, can you share with us more on what this means and how course writers and instructional designers should be thinking about AI in the classroom?
Yeah, so even today, and I run into a lot of, I wouldn't say trouble with this, but I run into a lot of people who push against me. So even today, most colleges, mine included, I'm not going to exclude us from this, have AI detection programs. We use Turnitin. They have a section of their website that actually does a scan of papers and gives you a percentage. And so we use Turnitin. Many other individuals or companies and schools use GPT-0 or whatever they're using, and they tend to come back with this percentage, right? The percent likelihood that it's human written or AI written or if it's a combination of them. And the vast majority of programs don't give you any logic behind that, right? I actually don't know of any that like lets you where really that's coming from. They might highlight some sections of it, but it's really just a percentage, some highlights, and then a number that you give students. And I'm opposed to it. I think we should push against this. And there are a couple of reasons why. One, it's just not accurate. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that AI detection programs are much more frequent, more likely to flag something that was written by someone who is a non-native speaker. And that is a huge problem. And it makes sense. If you are acquiring a language, you are going to use sentence structures that, yeah, might feel a little bit more quote-unquote robotic, right? You're picking it up.
Sure.
You are learning how to use it in a very building blocks way. And so that's going to come across these programs and it's going to be flagged. And that has happened. Another reason that I push against it. So there's the inaccuracy part. And then there's also just, hi, buddy. He wants to move around a lot. So also just what it does for the professor, educator, and student relationship. So I actually think that the situation right now with AI detectors isn't tenable. I don't think we can sustain it. So most colleges have these two ideas that they're throwing out there. One, that we should rely on AI detection programs, right? If you put it into an AI detection program and it says 100% AI or 90% AI, yes, it's accurate. Or even 50% AI, it's accurate. So that's what many faculty members are being told. But then they're being told something else. And this is where it gets destructive. You tell faculty members that if the student says that they didn't use it, they didn't use AI, the accusation won't hold up. And that is an incredibly destructive combination because, and this is happening, you have a student sending in a paper, whether it's AI written or not, it comes across with a high percentage on some scan. And then the educator has to approach the student and almost literally cross their fingers. They have to cross their fingers and say, don't push against me. Don't say, oh no, I didn't use it, or I used it this way, and things like that. And that is just, it's not a good situation. Mm-hmm. Because if we are wrong, this is one of the worst things you can do to a student. So for example, a few months ago, I wrote something on LinkedIn and I submitted the post. It was entirely written by me. I don't use AI for any end-to-end writing. I might use it for brainstorming, but everything I post, everything I submit, it's like entirely 100%. And I had someone accuse me of just writing it with ChatGPT, right, with the basic prompt. They said, oh, this is clearly AI written. And it emotionally wrecked me for the day. It made me think, what was there robotic about this? Right? This was from me. And they had their own reasons. It actually was the presence of typos, which was weird. But that doesn't really matter. What happened was how it affected me emotionally. And I'm 36 years old in a secure like position in my life. And if I were 15, that would be it. I would be done. There would be no coming back. Right? I don't think if I were like a 15-year-old or a 13-year-old or even like 17, if someone had an accusation of using AI in that way, and I didn't, right? If they were wrong, that would immediately derail me. And I don't know how or if I would have gotten back. So, and I think that we need to think about that emotional part of it. And so one of the things that I counsel faculty members to do as an exercise, and it only takes about 5 minutes, go into an AI detection program, anyone you want, and take your own work, take your own writing, take your own essays, articles, whatever you have, and just send them in. Just submit them, right? Put them into the AI detection program and just reflect on it. Reflect on that process, right? Of going through it and having things scanned and having it look at your sentences. Some of it will be highlighted likely, some of it won't be. I sent something in that I had written entirely on my own and it was like 73% AI generated, right? Wow. And I had written this 10 years ago, right? Like, so that's not a new thing. I wasn't writing it with ChatGPT or anything. Or even Grammarly.
Right.
It was basically pre that, or I wasn't using it at that point. And so for me, we need to push against that, or at least I am pushing against the use of AI detection programs. And so for me, it's going to be a lot about thinking about process. So thinking less about the output, because AI is getting just better and better every day with getting the human looking output, and more about finding ways in the assessment to have students show their process. And this is reflection. This is finding ways to bring us along the way as they, whether they're using it or not. And that seems more sustainable to me in many ways.
So imagine that I'm one of your students and I submit a written work. You have an inclination that maybe this is better than I am in terms of the writing quality, the content, yet on Turn It In gets a low percentage. What would the conversation be like?
So it would be, first of all, a message. I might talk to the student in person, but it would be an open conversation. So if that happens, one of the things I try to do is I try to show and demonstrate as much empathy as I possibly can. Mm-hmm. So the first step is by talking to a student, let them talk to you about the process. So let's just talk about what you did with writing this. And really, and trying to frame this as like a curious thing, like whether it went well, whether it went poorly, whatever it is, you can always ask the students about the process they went through. And you can do this even in person too, having them reflect. right? So what things popped up in your mind? How did you get through this idea, right? Where did this pop up from? And I don't even mean that in like a probing way, because I have that conversation. I can actually have that conversation from a space of curiosity. And if I do feel like, and part of it has to do with why I think it's AI generated. So if I do think it's AI generated, is it from quality, as you mentioned, or is it because there's something robotic about it? And if there is something robotic about it, then it becomes a part of the conversation, right? And I've actually sent this message to students like, oh, I looked at your paper and I noticed that all the sentences are constructed this way. So try to find out, try to identify why it feels robotic if you can. And that becomes a conversation. Mm-hmm. That you can actually say, oh, in the next one, you can try this. And there are different ways around that. So I would say that more often than not, it's about getting students to think about and talk about the process that went behind it. And maybe from there, you get more information. And you can also start to, for future assessments, find other ways to just encourage them to do their own work. There might be ways in that conversation that you find out that you can actually reshape future assignments. And for me, that makes the conversation productive more than anything else.
Love that approach.
Yeah, I like that.
But I think a lot of it just comes down to being open, being curious, and being honest with our students about what we know and we don't know. I think where the conversation becomes destructive is when student or teacher starts to dig their heels in, because that's the exact moment when they're not listening. Yeah. Right? That's the exact moment when they feel like they need to guard something, protect something. You can't, at least for me, have a constructive conversation from that space. So finding ways to think about the students. And you might find ways in that conversation that you might think, oh, this student really needs more agency. They need more autonomy. And that's for some students, that helps. For some students, that doesn't. And finding ways to personalize it for them as much as you can. But for me, the key is listening. And listening as actively and as sympathetically as you possibly can.
I think you're hitting on another really important part too, is that social presence. You're actually connecting with that student and asking them about their experience versus being accusational in any manner.
It really is a powerful, teachable moment to have that conversation.
Oh, I would just say that one of the hardest parts of that conversation is when the class is fully online. That does make it more difficult. Right? Because you don't have that physical presence. I think that if you are an on-site class, I'd be really appreciative of being able to have it in person. I actually think that's way easier than having it through a Zoom call, right? Sometimes it's a Zoom call, they won't turn their camera on, right? Or through an email. So having that relatively unmediated conversation, I think really helps, because in the end, what you want to do is you want to both recognize that you're both human and you both have these positions from which you want to help them out, and you want them to do the work, not just because, oh, you're the boss. You want them to do the work because that's how humans learn, right? That I can generate something that's probably pretty good through an AI program, but did I learn anything? Did I create anything I can take with me?
Right.
And just having that sort of understanding, I think is key. Now, I'm not going to naively suggest that this deals with the issue completely. Some students it will work, some students it won't. But I think that we have to really push ourselves to be empathetic and think about students as humans and have students think about us as humans, because that's really what it comes down to.
Absolutely. Technology becomes more sophisticated. We need to become more human.
There you go. I like that.
Yeah, I think so. And this is a good and a bad thing, that the rise of this technology, or just the popularization of this technology, should get us to think through humanity's value proposition. What are we bringing to the table? And I don't think it can be based off of competency. I think that's how a lot of people think about it, right? I can do blank, right? And machines cannot. And we see that what that does is it makes the space for humans get smaller and smaller and smaller as the AI gets more powerful. But thinking about, what is our value proposition if we have outputs that can be imitated pretty easily by a lot of AI programs with some basic prompting techniques? Like, what does that mean for humans? I think that's one of the big questions we should be grappling with. And that's something that I think we should be guiding our students with too.
Well, it's time for us to wrap up this week's episode, but make sure that you join us next week for part two of this fascinating conversation with Jason Golia.
Thank you for joining us on Digital to Learn.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are three things we ask you to do. One, come back and join us again. Two, tell your friends about us. And three, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Embrace the future.
Always keep learning.